Thanks for joining. We have another Direct Connect. Today I'm joined by two special guests, folks that have been around the industry for quite a while, a ton of experience, some of the people that I call when I have questions. We have Ike Atlas and Chris Ott. Ike, Chris, how you guys doing? Take a second to introduce yourselves.
Hey, yeah, doing well. Thanks for having us on. Appreciate it. My name is Ike Atlas. I'm the CSO and Security Director for Perimeter Security Solutions. We're a manufacturer and a security solutions provider out of Chicago.
And my name's Chris Ott. I've been in the security industry for a little over 22 years. I'm the senior security engineer for Power Engineers, which is a fairly sizable engineering and design firm that builds substations and generation facilities all across the nation.
So a lot of experience with the substation side of things. What kind of stuff are you guys seeing for substation security applications or installations out in the field? And then kind of a little bit more to add on to it, how has it evolved, or hasn't it, since the Metcalf attack almost 10 years ago?
I spent quite a bit of time out on the field, walking around these sites and at various utilities. And there's not something that's toe the line consistent across every utility. I'm seeing a lot of concrete perimeters going in for the very high criticality substations, and then some kind of metal barrier, expanded metal, welded wire, or a heavy gauge chain link, really is, as far as the physical barrier systems, really what I'm seeing.
Yeah, pretty much the same thing that we're seeing over here. You know, I like to say that some of the larger IOUs are using that big easy button, you know, like what Ike was saying, they're building that 20 or 25 foot tall wall all the way around the entire property. And then, you know, in some cases, that's kind of like hitting a nail with a 50 pound sledgehammer, you know, is effective, but is it efficient? You know, some of them are using that wait and see perspective with, you know, has negative financial or PR implications, obviously. We're seeing some of the smaller munis and PUDs because they're lower operating and investment costs. They're using technology and doing layers, which is a really good approach. You know, not using a single zone notifier because it could create a lot of false positives or even in some cases zero notifications. So, you know, if they use that multi-zonal approach, that way they can build themselves a buffer, right? Because really it all comes down to, you know, that detect, deter, delay. And I think the deter is the ideal method, but that in most cases is the most cost expensive approach. You know, being able to buy yourself some time between when an event occurs and when you can assess, communicate, and respond that to first responders is a really good approach. And I don't want to take up all the time, but you know, if walls aren't the most cost effective approach, expanded metal goes a long ways in, you know, preventing cut through because it usually takes power tools. It can help buy you some time before bad actors can get through that. And let's be honest, you know, if you're trying to shoot an object from, you know, 100 feet, 200 feet away through expanded metal, yeah, it's not ballistic rated, but it's going to deflect some bullets. So,
yeah, we've done quite a bit of ballistic testing. And you know, I say ballistics testing, it's really just kind of agnostic testing, right? See what happens to the bullet as it passes through different materials. And you're right, it either changes direction, deflects, or breaks up the bullet pretty good. And yep, we've had witness panels behind materials to, at you know, transform our body thickness, steel mm-hmm. panels. Does it pass through the fence material, and will it with enough velocity to actually hurt something on the other side? And I know a lot of times it's no. A lot of times it either breaks up or changes direction. And kind of going back to what you said on, you know, hitting the nail on the head with a 50-pound hammer, what I'm seeing, going back to the next question, really what I'm seeing across the board is people are starting to pay attention to design basis threat. Chris and I were just talking about that before we started recording. Design basis threat is becoming more at the forefront of the security manager's strategy. And they're starting to realize that, you know, just to just buying and installing materials without understanding what your threat is at every single location, because they're all different, that's becoming very important to them. So I'm glad to see that happening.
Yeah, you know, I think to Nick's point, early on in this standard, you know, back in 2014, 2015, a lot of folks were trying to take a subjective approach because everybody likes building facilities to a standard. And so if they can create a standard and say, okay, our high, medium, and lows are going to be X, Y, and Z, then it makes it easy to replicate. It makes it easy to estimate and build in a cost analysis for those. But as we've evolved, I think taking an objective approach is ideal, because no location's, you know, got a twin. You know, you have terrain differences, surrounding buildings are different. Maybe one location's got an apartment complex not far away. So as much as everybody wants to try and standardize their builds, and from an efficiency standpoint, it totally makes sense. It makes it a lot harder to adequately protect your assets, unless you look at them objectively.
Yeah, I think in order to get the consistency, Nick, I'm sorry, you're probably chomping at the bit to say
No.
something.
I'm just enjoying listening.
To add on to the consistency, I brought up the design basis threat. I think what goes along with that, just like detection and assessment, you can't have detection without assessment. I don't think you can have your design basis threat developed without an adversary sequence diagram to go along with that. I think that really provides some consistency and some cookie cutter effect, I guess you could say, across a utility's different styles of substations. Again, they're not all the same, but it does give you kind of, a baseline consistency, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things we're starting to see is more consistent analysis going into the design, using that design basis threat, the adversary sequence, and actually figuring out what they need before they start pouring concrete. Because the earlier days, and I'm sure you guys saw it as well, there was a lot of concrete poured, a lot of money spent on ballistic rated things that a lot of times I looked at it and went, what's the difference between a ballistic firewall and the standard firewall between the transformers? A stamp and a zero is kind of what I came away with it from. But kind of going into that, what other analysis you guys see? I know, Ike, you just touched on the design basis threat and the adversary sequence, which I think that's absolute bread and butter. But what else we see? And I know there's some cutting edge stuff. Chris, you got some really cool stuff out there. But and I know, Ike, I've seen some of the stuff that you've done in the past too. What else do people be doing when they're getting into that, either the upgrade or an initial build out?
Yeah, take it, Chris. I think for me, I think starting, that's the number one question for me. What's your threat? What's your design basis threat? Do you have one? And if they don't, we're starting right there, and then we're following up with the adversary sequence diagram, and then we're moving along. And
Yeah, so from a ballistic and gunfire standpoint, you know, historically people have used a combination of trigonometry, personal experience, some cases best guess, right? Which is never really the best approach. Using, you know, some range finders, spotting scopes, and they try and identify where they think the target might sit. So what we've done over where I'm at now is we've created a very neat ballistic line of sight 3D methodology. And so what we're doing is we're using a combination of building informational modeling, also known as BIM. You combine that with photogrammetry, LiDAR data, and we're inserting it into game engine software. And then what we're able to do with that is we're able to create a proposed location or recreate an existing location. We then identify the critical assets that need the protection, and we work our way from the inside out, and we are able to replicate in 3D with photo illuminators in the software, and that shows us where the vulnerable threat vectors are at. With that information, we're then allowed or we're able to take security protections like walls, barriers, technology, and place them in various different places in this model to validate that these protections are going to be effective. It can be used as possible evidence in the event of an audit because it's giving you an accurate representation of either what you're doing currently or what your plan is. And in every single case where we've done this, all of our clients have been ecstatic. The use cases just keep growing and growing. So when you talk about the cost of implementing security protections or the cost of, building a new substation. I mean, we're fractions of a penny on the dollar. And in most cases, we can turn an entire study around in 6 weeks or less.
Yeah. I love that technology. I was working on that type of stuff, 8 or 10 years ago, and it's come a very, very long way. And the cost is, frankly, just like you said, the cost w used to be super high to do some kind of LiDAR scan or photogrammetry
Yeah.
stuff, but it's really come down.
What's really helped bring drive that cost down and increase the speed that we're able to do this is, I mean, just the progress of technology. I mean, video cards have gotten so much better in just the last 5 years. Computing power has quadrupled itself in the past 5 years. So being able to take all of that data, process it, and spit out a model, I mean, we can do that in a matter of weeks. Whereas 3, 4 years ago, it would take a couple of months.
Yeah, combine that with your threat analysis, your the again the design basis threat, and you can do tabletops all day long with those programs. You run those adversary sequence diagrams and understand infinite pathways and the delays, inherent in those pathways.
That's a great point, Ike. That was something I did at a client a couple of years ago. We actually took all their adversary sequence diagrams and their design basis threats and turned that over to their exercise program that became their SIP 14 exercise side. And then they actually were attacked at non-SIP 14 sites, but the lessons learned from doing those on their SIP 14 substations carried through. And ultimately, they were, I think, fully recovered in under a month with two substations attacked with small arms. So,
Yeah,
whole lot better than 3 or 4 years.
we scanned a an interior stadium and turned it into a model, turned it into a gaming platform to where they can run emergency drills, active shooter drills, mass egress drills on their fire escapes and stuff like that, and I get all of that data straight off that program.
Yeah, I think on the analysis piece, there's the substation that all three of us end up just kind of worked on and found out at ISC West that all three of us have been involved in it. But I would say on that one, just from a high perspective, going through doing the design basis threat and then doing the modeling analysis, I would just guesstimate it from doing the R6 review walking by that probably saved that utility well into the seven figures. Because the advice before that was ballistic wall in a number of spots, concrete wall around the entire perimeter, and it wasn't needed. I don't know what you guys think, but I think that's millions of dollars that now gets to get spent somewhere else that actually moves the needle for risk.
I mean, we're all ratepayers in some fashion, way or another, and so nobody likes seeing their rates increased. And so if you can really increase the efficiency or drive down the cost of a build and increase your protections, everybody wins.
Yeah, I would say all in for I think all the work that we did, they're probably under $100,000, maybe 200 at the most, to save a couple million or potentially even 8, 9 million. I think even the tightest CFO is going to look at that and give that the thumbs up. But so many places I see where they're just not they haven't got to that maturity level yet, and I think that's a missed opportunity. Shifting a little bit to kind of as much as we can, the crystal ball that is NERC looks a lot like an 8 ball most days. But they're in the process of updating SIP 14. I don't have an idea particularly where that's going to go, although every piece I've heard back is just to expect more substations in scope. I think that's a pretty safe assumption, anywhere from I think a few additional to 3 to 4 times as many as we have right now. Not getting too far into that, but just assume we're talking to someone who's got a new SIP 14 substation. What advice are you going to give them? And is it the same if it's they're adding it one more SIP 14 site to the existing seven they already have, or they're brand new to SIP 14?
Well, that's a hard one to answer. And this is probably not a direct answer, but hoping to help give some guidance. What we're seeing and recommending is utilities to create a tier level, right? And classify these locations from their standpoint, whether it be the amount of revenue that runs through that facility or the communities that it serves or even where it sits on the book electric system. right? And so that way they can categorize these, higher tiered locations, whether they're SIP 14 or not, in preparation that maybe they will be one day. Because, everybody knows standards change, they grow, they mature. That way they can start building their beginning protections into these builds or remodels for that matter. So that's the best answer that I can give.
I think I'm going to continue to harp on the design basis threat and the ASD stuff. I think if you're building, adding a site, whether you're building a new one and adding to it, or you're just, like you said, bringing one in that's existing because of the new standard, go back to your design basis threat. Don't just, again, don't just go off experience or, some magic crystal ball. Look at your terrain, look at the topology. Look at everything, that's everything that can harm you. Build out your design basis threat and apply that to meeting the new standard or meeting any standard.
I like that answer, Ike. And I'd even go as far as saying everybody who creates their DBT process, it's probably a really good idea to find some experienced professionals to take a look at that DBT process and see if there are any gaps. I mean, even the best security groups out there, and there are a lot of them, they're not perfect. We're all human beings. And so a second set of eyes, or in some cases a third set of eyes, can either validate or identify some areas where they need to be tightened up.
Yeah, I agree. And I also think that you can look at future. You can develop a future design basis threat. You don't have to play in the world of the one that you have now. You can tabletop it for, for lack of better terms, tabletop your design basis threat on all the different things, where it can go up or down. And I think people will find out that the systems that you need to put in place for a DBT plus or a DBT plus one or plus two isn't that much more than what you're already deciding, that you're already kind of implementing at the time. So I think you can even stay a step ahead of your threat. Just do some future DBT development and see what that one more thing or those two more things that you can add or even take away and replace something with a new and fresh, technology, whatever it is.
And it needs to also be kind of a living, breathing document, right? Society changes, technology changes, bad actors and their thought process, that changes. So just creating a process, a standard, or a DBT, you can't just be a one and done. You're going to have to revisit it either annually, biannually, come up with some sort of process to evaluate what you're doing. Technology that came out 4 years ago, may not be the best technology as today. A technology that works in the Pacific Northwest may not work very well down in, Florida, for example. They've got different weather and different environments. So, something to consider there.
Absolutely.
I love that future-proofing concept. I know one of my partners and I, Brian Carr, we just worked with a client who they're in the greenfield stage of building up what's going to be a SIP 14 site. And we give a recommendation to run all the conduit, but don't put anything in it yet, because right now running conduit when you're in construction phase, pennies on the dollar. Refitting, particularly in a substation, I know I ran into a case where I was trying to put a technology out and I needed 10 more feet of low voltage, 110 power, and that was going to be probably $1 million to run it because of where it sat. So if they'd done it 50 years ago when they built the substation, it probably wouldn't even been a change order. It would have been, oh yeah, just run it over there. So I think that's a key piece to looking forward looking. Especially if you have a chance with an electrified substation, it's de-energized, crack that thing open. I think that's huge.
Yeah, I think going back to Chris's tool, I think you can, I mean, getting down to the nitty-gritty, even camera views, right? You can use your tool to fly up and look at camera fields of view and basically snapshot that, give it to your integrator and say, climb up the pole and make the view look exactly like this. So he's not coming down saying, is this what you want? And then he climbs back up for another $1,000. So you're cutting a lot of cost off of that with that tool also.
Yeah, a lot of analysis. That's what I would recommend to anybody, whether it's their first SIP 14 site or their 28th. Do the analysis, do your homework on the front end, because the expense or the mistakes are expensive, and the one size fits all is expensive. And I know I've had to stand in front of the CFO and the CEO and the board and explain why I spent certain money, always helpful to have that homework to lean on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, in our case, when we go through and we do these analysis and we capture all this data, the client owns that data, right? So we give them that, the raw form, even after we're done doing the model, after we're done doing the study. So if they want to take a look at it in a year or two from now and revisit it, just load it back into the software. You can make some changes depending on if, you know, a neighborhood grows or expands. You know, it's not massive. So
yeah, and like I said before, add in that future design basis threat. Add in, you know, little things that create a little bit more delay, and run your adversary sequence diagram again and see what that gives you.
Yeah, one of my favorite ways to do that future sequence or the future piece is to find the person who's worked at that utility for 20 years and say, all right, when you were working at midnight and it was snowing out, what kind of crazy ideas did you come up with? Because they've got good ones. That's a good way to get around that failure of imagination. But, well, guys, any parting thoughts before we wrap up? If not, then let people know where to find you. I know you guys are a wealth of information. Chris, let's lead off with you.
Sure. Yeah, you can get a hold of me at chris.ott@powereng.com. It's my email address. Or just go to our website and click around, and you can find somebody who can get a hold of me. But my email address is the best way.
Yeah, I appreciate the conversation, Nick. Thanks for having us on. My email address is atlasi@perimetersecuritysolutions.com, or like Chris said, just run to the website, perimetersecuritysolutions.com, and look around. And most of those buttons come to me anyways.
Any other comments? Yeah, thanks, guys. Always learn a lot when I talk to you too.
Yeah, it goes both ways. Thanks, Nick.
All right.
Take care.
Not only is Direct Connect available to listen to, you can also watch each episode on our YouTube channel. Just go to youtube.com/@ArcherU. If you're interested in who we are and what we do, you can head on over to our website at archerint.com. You can also follow us on our social media platforms, Archer International on Facebook, Archer Energy Solutions LLC on LinkedIn, and @ArcherSEC on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and check back every other week for brand new episodes of Direct Connect.